This is Tech on the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Ben Johnson.
HBO's show Westworld, loosely based on the 1973 sci-fi film, follows a winding story of an adult theme park populated by humanoid cowboy robots run by a shadowy corporation and full of big questions about consciousness and artificial intelligence that is starting to become self-aware.
Have you ever questioned the nature of your reality?
Westworld's first season has garnered Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild nominations. Since a lot of people might be signing up for HBO streaming services with their new devices this week, Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan are the co-creators of Westworld. They also write and produce the series that airs on HBO. We have reached them at their office in Burbank, California. Lisa, Jonah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So a lot of the show seems connected to a larger conversation that we're all having right now about artificial intelligence. Why'd you choose this topic?
It feels a little more like the topic chose us. I think as a writer, you're often looking for or trying to understand the moment that you're in on a sort of a broader perspective. And obviously, this is a topic that a lot of great writers and filmmakers have been dealing with for decades. I mean, Crichton made the original film in 73.
Right.
But for me in particular, I think that the question of AI is something that has become ever more sort of increasingly urgent as we feel it start to seep into our lives. And I think filmmakers were preparing us for one big moment, kind of a singularity moment. And what's happening instead is it's sort of coming in at the fringes. It's coming in by way of Siri and Google and Facebook.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see it impact elections and our daily lives. And so, you know, for us, this felt like this is the topic of our moment very much.
Lisa, do you feel like you guys have some responsibility in that regard as you tell this story? I mean, obviously this is fiction and you guys are you know, fictional storytellers, but it is really connected to a lot of the conversations that we're having now in real life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reflection of where our technology is growing. Of course, you know, the way that AI is developing right now is more in kind of narrow spikes, not necessarily as anthropomorphic creatures designed to look like us. And
sure.
That's the way the part in our show is an allegory for human nature, you know. So we use technology as a lens to examine ourselves.
You know, it's really interesting to me. You guys, this is science fiction. A lot of science fiction often relies too much on the special technology effects and the moral of the story and not enough on the drama. And I think you guys really avoided that misstep. How do you think you avoided it? And were you conscious of trying to avoid that sort of like, I don't know, you know, not great storytelling, but great special effects kind of misstep as you're creating sci-fi?
I think to Lisa's point, it was about concentrating on the human nature of our inhuman protagonists. And we spent a lot of time preparing and researching and testing a more vis-effects and special effects heavy approach to the show. You know, and there's a lot of beautiful vis-effects work in the show. But when we got into it with our cast, and it is a spectacular cast, we found that so much of what they were giving us in their performance was so relatable and terrifying that they really, you know, exhibited the sort of inhuman contours of their characters in very humane ways. And it was a lot of conversations that we had with the actors in terms of how their dissonance would manifest itself, how you would see that. And so we wanted the technology throughout the show to feel seamless and kind of invisible.
Sure.
But we wanted specifically the technology, the host, to present itself through performance. And that's what, that, you know, 95% of what you're seeing on the screen is actors' performances. You know, it's Evan Rachel Wood and Tandy Newton, James Marsden and Jeffrey Wright, you know, making you feel the kind of existential panic of, you know, their inhumanity.
Now, I know you're co-creator. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and in addition to our wonderful, warm and incredibly human performances, you know, I think that the way in which in the pilot, Jonah started off even filmically approaching this, you know, he filmed it on film instead of digital, and it gave, especially the scenes for me above ground in this artificial reality, quote unquote, this incredibly warm, sumptuous, alive feeling. And I think that creating the world in those warm hues also helped to take away the kind of coldness of what can be associated with sci-fi.
Interesting. I know your co-creators, and producers. What was the biggest technical challenge in creating the show for you guys?
We had a couple of specific things that were challenging. The great thing, building the map in the red room, the sort of surveillance room. We wanted to do it practically. We'd had a lot of luck. My brother on our last project together, Interstellar, had used a lot of projection, and that had given the actors something to perform to. We went through sort of a low point over the last 10 years in film, where actors were being asked to stand on green screen stages and kind of interact with green props or, other actors who were covered in tiny little ping pong balls, all this kind of, nonsense.
The Gollum challenge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And look, there's some beautiful work that's been done there and nothing to take nothing away from that. But we're now in a place where we're able to, InvisFX has sort of advanced to the point where we can build from reality. We can go and shoot in the real places. We were lucky here to have a network that had great success with Game of Thrones, shooting in the real places. You don't need to use green screen to make something look like Morocco. Just go shoot in Morocco. So we went to Utah and shot out in Utah, and it was challenging, but the results were spectacular.
I was just telling Jonah the other day how the scariest day of the shoot for me was I was holding our newborn and watching Jonah take off in a helicopter off a butte, and it just went off this giant cliff to get a shot for the pilot. And I thought, my God, this could all go so horribly wrong.
Which is another fundamental idea in the show, I suppose.
Right, exactly. Yes,
indeed.
There are some literary references in the name titles, I know. Can you talk a little bit about some of the inspiration for the work?
In the main titles or in the which area?
Episode titles. I'm thinking of the by Cameral Mind, I think, is one of the.
Oh right! Yes.
Yeah.
In sort of looking at the problem, what they call the hard problem of consciousness, what we discovered, and we really wanted to make an earnest effort to the degree that, that either of us could shed any insight on a problem that has mystified humanity for millennia. We did a lot of reading, did a lot of research, read a lot of interesting people, everyone from Marvin Minsky to Julian Jaynes and everyone in between. And a lot of that suffused itself into the work. What we were fascinated to come to realize is that even in this moment in which we feel ever closer to achieving general artificial intelligence, or you have several Fortune 500 companies aggressively, trying to build this, the question of consciousness is still something largely approached by philosophers. Computer scientists kind of don't want anything to do with it because they know it's a bit of a black hole. We still have so few answers about our own consciousness, even in a moment in which it feels like we're getting ever closer to building an artificial version of it. So we threaded a lot of those ideas from Gödel, Escher, Bach to the breakdown of the bicameral mind throughout the narrative as homage to the writers that we read, but also in an earnest attempt to convey what we felt. After a year or two of thinking about this, really composed the sort of elements of consciousness. And one of those elements was storytelling. And we wound up, really spending a lot of time considering the idea of, and in large part, it's one of the big themes of the show. What is storytelling? In an era of peak TV, why do we need 400 shows? What is drama doing for us as human beings? Why are we so hooked on this drug?
Well, you've also had an amazing response to the show online with people talking about it on Reddit and Twitter and sort of coming up with theories as the show aired, at least the first season. But you've also said that you hope people will watch and write about the show differently in the next season. What do you mean?
I think what we're talking about is just it's a new frontier a bit in how the interplay between speculation and criticism and spoilers, we're fans of all of it. And I think that there's a really great opportunity for viewers and critics to watch this in a wide assortment of ways that they find fulfilling. And I think the thing that got a little muddled on this show particularly is when speculation was really just picking up breadcrumbs that we were consciously weaving through the story for certain people to find at their own pace.
Sure.
And when an amazing site like Reddit, which has this incredible power of a hive mind, starts piecing it together in this community, that's wonderful and great. But, you know, for my parents who just wanted to see the show and be surprised, they don't go on Reddit. They might get a couple headlines that, that show up when they surf the web. And I think for them, they just didn't want to see the Reddit pontifications as a headline because then it might spoil it for them. And they kind of wanted to stay pure to that experience.
Mm. Well, it's kind of a fascinating moment. You know, the show's about artificial intelligence. And that comes in many different forms. If you read Superintelligence, for instance, one of the great books, recent books about AI. You know, there are different forms of superintelligence. You know, one of them is aggregated human intelligence. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's been fascinating to watch with this show is the way that the internet has evolved over the last 10 or 15 years. You have sites like Reddit in which observations can not only be cataloged, but also cataloged in a hierarchical fashion, which, and look, there's a lot of discussion about the amazing things that Reddit is capable of and the terrible things that it's capable of. You know, it's been in front of some things, it's been behind. Twitter is an analog for the same thing. You know, tweets get retweeted, they get voted up. So you have this sort of meta form of aggregated human intelligence that's very powerful. And when it's applied to a narrative like this, things that are woven in as kind of subtleties become picked apart in a way that's very gratifying for creators. You spend all this time building these things. It's very exciting to see people picking up on them. But there's the power now for the internet to kind of get out in front of these things. And so it's just a question of deploying that power carefully, especially when you're talking about something. I mean, again, these aren't state secrets. This is just, it's just a TV show.
Right. Well, but it is interesting because you really, in the show, you do play with this idea that you hinted at earlier, which is we're in this moment where a lot of people are building things for the sake of building them. And sometimes there's not a lot of deep thought necessarily about what that means and what the impact might mean, right? I feel like you guys are touching on this with the show as well.
I think that it's part of what human nature is for absolutely everyone. You know, we tend to be a little myopic when it comes to our passions, and I'm no different. You know, when I'm writing, I'm just thinking about the script. And so people tend to pursue their passions with a kind of single-mindedness, and that's engineered into us, right? It's take care of yourself, take care of your family. But there comes a point too where the question becomes, especially with new technologies and, you know, weaponry and even art, it becomes, what is your responsibility in terms of thinking about the externalities of the things that you produce? When do you start to have to consider morally your obligation to others?
Yeah, and I think with artificial intelligence, you're seeing a headlong rush here, analogous to what was happening in the 1970s with genetic research and bioresearch. We had the Aslan Omar conference where they put in a self-imposed moratorium for a couple of years to say, hey, we're getting really good at this. And we need to stop and talk about best methodologies. And I think that's the call coming now from people like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking saying two things. One, AI research should be something we all talk about. It shouldn't be, you know, this sort of a corporate arms race to try to advance, you know, like who you know, becomes sentient first, Siri or Alexa, right? Like,
right.
We want to have a more collective conversation about what that means and, you know, how to manage that process. Because I think the people who are looking deeply into this problem see a lot of different ways in which it can get very strange over the
dicey
next 10 or 20 years.
Right. Yeah. At one level, the show is about, robots that are built to entertain, which is why I think the mechanized player piano is such an interesting character in the first season And people really responded to that and talked a lot about the different music that was being played on the piano. But this is also this kind of this robot that has been built to entertain. Can you talk a little bit about where the idea of incorporating that came from?
Yeah, we, you know, Lisa and I were casting about at the script level for the pilot for an image that summed up the sort of plight of our characters and something we come back to. And then selfishly, I wanted an excuse to be able to use contemporary music in the show. One, because it would remind the audience that that they're not in a Western, they're in a meta-Western. And two, there's just a great emotional power from, and it seemed to connect in very nice ways to the story we were telling, with the familiarity of certain elements and tropes that have been woven into the park. The idea that the soundtrack would be composed of contemporary music as well was something we found irresistible. The piano is actually now in our office. Over the course of the season, it became sentient.
Nice.
And it's now renegotiating its contract for the second season.
Do either of you, I'm interested in a response from both of you. Do you think artificial intelligence should have rights and be sentient and free?
I think it depends on where artificial intelligence is. You know, the kind of cautionary tale of Westworld is, you know, you can't define humanity and life by just exactly what we are, you know, born of a womb and our kind of womb and alive, but you have to consider behaviors and feelings and different methods of cognition. I think we're still a long way from that. But what I do think is an imperative in the short term is, you know, setting early boundaries for the development of artificial intelligence, so that should it have a kind of exponential growth down the road, we're prepared for it. You know, we've seen so much recently, especially with these technologies that we've embraced wholeheartedly that have changed and improved the world, like email, for example, you know?
Has it improved the world?
Well, yeah, I know.
Has it improved the world?
I know.
Great question.
Exactly. And it seemed, it kind of Trojan horsed its way into all of our lives. I mean, how many times do we each check email every day in the name of efficiency? And it just seemed, I remember I was in law school not that many years ago, and we had this talk about privacy rights, and it all seemed so incredibly abstract. Like, who would care about, you know, our emails or our little things? And then, you know, within less than a decade, we've seen, my God, this tiny, you know, leap in technology can lead to grand scale change on a global level. And I think that's why we have to be so careful about envisioning the long-term effects of even the simplest technological advances. And even though, you know, we work in the realm of fiction, fiction in that sense goes hand in hand with technology in terms of speculating and envisioning different scenarios that could occur. And, you know, Jonah talked about the importance of storytelling. Part of the importance of storytelling is, and, you know, if you have a kid, you see how many stories are actually cautionary tales because you're trying to groom a young life to avoid massive mistakes that start off innocuously. And I think that's part of what we're doing.
Mr. Yeah, Nolan?
I think for me, I'm a little less optimistic, not quite the right word. I don't think these things are quite as far away as Lisa does. You know, there have been several moments over the last 40 years in which it's felt like an AI revolution was imminent. And we've always been wrong, right? There was a moment like this in the 60s, in the 80s, and now in our moment. But it's a little like they were sketching the airport before, and now we've built it. You know, we've laid the runway. We're now tinkering with the engines. I think it's closer than anyone imagines. I think the DeepMind, I mean, look, you have, and I do believe that AI will emerge in ways that aren't yet
imagined.
Readily, yeah, imagined or conceived. I've done a couple of projects now. My last TV show was about the idea of networked intelligence.
Yeah.
I think it's going to come at us in a way we'll get blindsided a little bit. And I do believe that if you're dealing with a general intelligence or an intelligence explosion, you're going to have to think through, what obligations we have to those right. creatures. 100%.
Yeah.
But I do believe if human history is a guide, we'll continue to move those goalposts very conservatively until we create a problem, which is part of what the show is about.
Sure.
So, but I think we've also laid in place certain mechanisms. If part of our society is game-like, and demonstrably, a lot of the way our society is structured has a game-like component to it. Mm-hmm. When DeepMind beat the world Go champion earlier
sure.
in the year,
Google's DeepMind, they're yeah.
That's a seismic moment. It's hard to appreciate because, Go isn't played a lot in the United States. But the added complexity beyond chess, we're now in a place where we have no games that we are better at than the AI. And to the degree that the rest of our society is structured in game-like fashions, whether you're talking about, free and open markets, the stock exchange, all the rest of these things,
sure.
we're now creating a something that, is better than we are at almost any intellectual pursuit we can imagine.
So, you're freaking me out.
to imagine that we haven't stopped for a second and had a conversation about how we want the next 50 years to play out seems like
sure.
A missed opportunity.
I just have a couple more questions for you guys. Do the hosts eat and defecate? this is something that a lot of people have been wondering about.
Stay tuned.
What, we're going to have an episode on eating and defecation?
No. It's HBO, man.
And can you... So I guess that's a pass. Is that a pass?
No, we do imagine the guns? We've had old Bill drinking whiskey with Ford and host eating along the trail. You'd be a little less charmed by a trail partner who wasn't interested in breaking bread with you. So they have to deal with it somehow.
I think the main biological difference that we always envisioned wasn't in the body, which, is being printed and engineered to be organic, but is in the brain. So the brain is the real difference, right? It's immortal. It doesn't necessarily require oxygen in the same way, but the rest of the body can do things that our bodies can do.
Oh yeah. How are they powered? This is another question I had watching this show.
Well, that is definitely something that we'll get into in the second season.
Okay. Fair enough. How do the guns work? Can you guys talk about that or how you thought about that in creating the first season?
It's tricky because it's one of the things in the original film that you kind of go, well, why would they even build the capacity for this to go wrong?
right.
But then we spent a lot more time on, on firing ranges and talking to people and looking at the odd intersection between paintball and then the simmunitions used by special operations teams in training. They trained originally with paintball weapons, and then a manufacturer came along and said, no, you want to, it was important for those people to be training with their actual weapons. And so, they created simunitions, what are called simunitions, which are rounds that can be fired from conventional weapon, but that have the same impact and an effect as a sort of a paintball round. They hurt, but they don't injure. For us, it was a leap, especially when you have multiply redundant systems, like all the different surveillance systems in the park that are, making the place essentially foolproof. The idea that you could have ammunition that responded differently to different targets felt a little more believable. So for the players, and we also like the idea, that for the players, it isn't just a free ride. If they want to have a shootout, the classic Western shootout.
Right. They're going to have
the possibility of some consequences. I remember playing paintball up here in Southern California at one point with a bunch of 15-year-old kids, and those kids don't mess around. Hit with a paintball from a gun that had been tuned up a little bit and left a welt for weeks. So it's somewhere in the intersection of Yeah, a little bit of verisimilitude for the players and a lot of satisfaction for them when they're dispatching their enemies.
Now, we've had some hints of what the next season may touch on when it comes in 2018 in terms of a kind of samurai world. Are there going to be other worlds beyond that? I mean, I'm thinking back, of course, to the original film. Can you guys hint at all about what kind of worlds may be revealed to us eventually?
You know, one of the core conceits of the show has been to, you know, constrain the point of view. And it was a very conscious choice from the pilot on to that of the host, because it helped to get us over the uncanny valley. It helped us really humanize creatures that we otherwise, had we gone into knowing they're the other, they're manufactured, we would have felt a distance from as the audience. And so,
sure.
Basically, we learn about the world as they learn about it, so that we feel closer to these hosts. And I think that's a trend that will continue in second season. So you know, not to be totally elliptical, but we'll see what worlds are out there when they see them.
The politest version of no comment.
That's right. Fair answer. Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan are the co-creators of Westworld. They also write and produce the series that airs on HBO. Lisa, Jonah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.